For the first time also we encounter social conflicts comparable to our own. Money has superseded barter, and financial capital has become fluid and free, not perhaps so fluid and free as it is today, but much more so than it had ever been before. The Punic Wars were wars of peoples, such as were no other wars we have yet recorded. Indubitably, the broad lines of our present world, the main ideas, the chief oppositions, were appearing in those days. But as we've already pointed out, certain of the elementary facilities and some of the current political ideas of our time were still wanting in the Rome of the Punic Wars. There were no newspapers, and there was practically no use of elected representatives in the popular assemblies. And another deficiency, very understandable to us nowadays, but quite beyond the scope of anyone then, was the absence of any general elementary political education at all. The plebeians of Rome had shown some glimmering of the idea that without knowledge, votes can't make men free, when they had insisted upon the publication of the Law of the Twelve Tables. But they'd never been able, it was beyond the possibilities of the time, to imagine any further extension of knowledge to the bulk of the people. It's only nowadays that men are beginning to understand fully the political significance of the maxim that knowledge is power. Two British trade unions, for example, have recently set up a labour college to meet the special needs of able working men in history, political and social science, and the like. But education in Republican Rome was the freak of the individual parent, and the privilege of wealth and leisure. It was mainly in the hands of Greeks, who were in many cases slaves. There was a thin, small stream of very fine learning and very fine thinking up to the first century of the monarchy, let Lucretius and Cicero witness, but it didn't spread into the mass of the people. The ordinary Roman was not only blankly ignorant of the history of mankind, but also of the conditions of foreign peoples. He had no knowledge of economic laws, nor of social possibilities. Even his own interests he didn't clearly understand. Of course, in the little city-states of Greece, and in that early Roman state of 400 square miles, men acquired by talk and observation a sufficient knowledge for the ordinary duties of citizenship. But by the beginning of the Punic Wars, the business was already too big and complicated for illiterate men. Yet nobody seems to have observed the gap that was opening between the citizen and his state, and so there's no record at all of any attempt to enlarge the citizen by instruction to meet his enlarged duties. From the 2nd century BC and onward, everyone is remarking upon the ignorance of the common citizen and his lack of political wisdom. Everything is suffering from the lack of political solidarity due to this ignorance. But no one goes on to what we should now consider the inevitable corollary. No one proposes to destroy the ignorance complained of. There existed no means whatever for the instruction of the masses of the people in a common political and social ideal. It was only with the development of the great propagandist religions in the Roman world, of which Christianity was the chief and the survivor, that the possibility of such a systematic instruction of great masses of people became apparent in the world. That very great political genius, the Emperor Constantine the Great, 6 centuries later, was the first to apprehend and to attempt to use this possibility for the preservation and the mental and moral knitting together of the world community over which he ruled. But it's not only in these deficiencies of news and of education, and of the expedient of representative government, that this political system of Rome differed from our own. True, it was far more like a modern civilized state than any other state we've considered hitherto, but in some matters it was strangely primordial and sub-civilized. Every now and then the reader of Roman history, reading it in terms of debates and measures, policies and campaigns, capital and labor, comes upon something that gives him much the same shock he would feel if he went down to an unknown caller in his house and extended his hand to meet the misshapen, hairy paw of Homo Neanderthalensis and looked up to see a chinless, bestial face. We've noted the occurrence of human sacrifice in the 3rd century BC, and much that we learn of the religion of Republican Rome carries us far back beyond the days of decent gods, to the age of shamanism and magic. We talk of a legislative gathering, and the mind flies to Westminster, but how should we feel if we went to see the beginning of a session of the House of Lords and discovered the Lord Chancellor with bloody fingers portentously fiddling about among the entrails of a newly killed sheep? The mind would recoil from Westminster to the customs of Benin. And the slavery of Rome was a savage slavery, altogether viler than the slavery of Babylon. We've had a glimpse of the virtuous Cato among his slaves in the 2nd century BC. Moreover, in the 3rd century BC, when King Asoka was ruling India in light and gentleness, the Romans were reviving an Etruscan sport, the setting on of slaves to fight for their lives. One's reminded of West Africa again in the origin of this amusement. It grew out of the prehistoric custom of a massacre of captives at the burial of a chief. There was a religious touch about this sport. The slaves with hooks, who dragged the dead bodies out of the arena, wore masks to represent the infernal ferryman god Charon. In 264 BC, the very year in which Asoka began to reign and the First Punic War began, the first recorded gladiatorial combat took place in the Forum at Rome to celebrate the funeral of a member of the old Roman family of Brutus. This was a modest display of three couples, but soon gladiators were fighting by the hundred. The taste for these combats grew rapidly, and the wars supplied an abundance of captives. The old Roman moralists, who were so severe upon kissing and women's ornaments and Greek philosophy, had nothing but good to say for this new development. So long as pain was inflicted, the Roman morality, it would seem, was satisfied. If Republican Rome was the first of modern self-governing national communities, she was certainly the Neanderthal form of them. In the course of the next 2 or 3 centuries, the gladiatorial shows of Rome grew to immense proportions. To begin with, while wars were frequent, the gladiators were prisoners of war. They came with their characteristic national weapons, tattooed Britons, Moors, Scythians, Negroes, and the like, and there was perhaps some military value in these exhibitions. Then criminals of the lower classes condemned to death were also used. The ancient world didn't understand that a criminal condemned to death still has rights, and at any rate the use of a criminal as a gladiator wasn't so bad as his use as material for the vivisectors of the museum at Alexandria. But as the profits of this sort of show business grew, and the demand for victims increased, ordinary slaves were sold to the trainers of gladiators, and any slave who had aroused his owner's spite might find himself in an establishment for letting out gladiators. And dissipated young men who had squandered their property and lads of spirit would go voluntarily into the trade for a stated time, trusting to their prowess to survive. As the business developed, a new use was found for gladiators as armed retainers. Rich men would buy a band and employ it as a bodyguard or hire it out for profit at the shows. The festivities of a show began with a ceremonial procession, pompa, and a sham fight, prelusio. The real fighting was heralded by trumpets. Gladiators who objected to fight for any reason were driven on by whips and hot irons. A wounded man would sometimes call for pity by holding up his forefinger. The spectators would then either wave their handkerchiefs in token of mercy or condemn him to death by holding out their clenched fists with the thumbs down. The slain, or nearly dead, were dragged out to a particular place, the spoliarium, where they were stripped of their arms and possessions, and those who hadn't already expired were killed. This organization of murder as a sport and show serves to measure the great gap in moral standards between the Roman community and our own. No doubt cruelties and outrages upon human dignity as monstrous as this still go on in the world, but they don't go on in the name of the law and without a single dissentient voice. For it's true that until the time of Seneca, the 1st century AD, there's no record of any plain protest against this business. The conscience of mankind was weaker and less intelligent then than now. Presently, a new power was to come into the human conscience through the spread of Christianity. The spirit of Jesus in Christianity became the great antagonist to the later Roman state of these cruel shows and of slavery, and as Christianity spread, these two evil things dwindled and disappeared.